Transit Voices with Ben Whitaker.
Welcome to Transit Voices. This week, wow, we have Sampo Hirtinen giving us the 20-year arc of MaaS, the Mobility as a Service movement. He reframes the entire thing like what happened with the telecoms industry, where we went from walled gardens and no roaming. Can we take transit into the world of roaming? We also go into the real findings behind subscription-based MaaS, the most extreme and full version of MaaS, and where he sees that working. The disagreement between us, where I think Sampo and MaaS Global see single point of payment as the most important key on MaaS, and what he sees for the future, for mobility as a feature. Without further ado, let's find out more from Sampo.
Now, let's get talking.
Sampo Hirtinen, thank you so much for coming in, especially now to speak to us at Transit Voices. Of course, like everyone in the industry, we've watched the meteoric rise under your WIM application of the MaaS movement. So many projects, so many companies in this space. And as we all heard last week, officially MaaS Global going into bankruptcy protection. This is a very poignant moment, and I'm sure a very difficult moment for your team. So thank you so much for coming on to speak to us today. I mean, we can't ignore the elephant in the room. It's been a real journey for you. I mean, can you give us a bit of feedback on, I think we all know what it is that MaaS set out to do. What would you say is your sort of reflection on what you've learnt and your framing for what it's now going to become, what your framing of it is?
Oh, we only have half an hour, so I probably won't have enough time for stories. I think that there will be enough stories for a book or two, and even more so. Let me try my best to kind of frame it. The concept of MaaS, at least how it was born to me, was roughly actually about 20 years ago. I saw my first slides about the MaaS concept as we see it, or actually haven't even gotten that far yet. It came more as a prediction of what is a likely scenario of digital disruption within the industry. Looking at the, let's say, other sectors like telecom or media or such, and trying to figure out, okay, so what would happen to our industry and what would be the end game at some point, without, of course, putting any time label or anything into it, but what's the likely scenario? And trying to figure that one out. And of course, coming from Finland, and that was early 2000s, the clear analogy was the disruption in telecom industry. It was kind of a revelation to think about it, that okay, in the 80s, telecom business was not a sexy business. It was a boring one, not really worth anything, not worth investing or putting anything into it. But then when it started to really change, it became international, became something where you do a lot of R&D and it makes a lot of sense, and so on and so on. It's more or less, it had carried the world economic growth even for some decades then. And trying to make a comparison that, okay, how would that same look like in our beloved industry of mobility? And then I started thinking about the business layers. You know, you have the infrastructure. In the 80s, all the telecom infrastructure, it was more or less politically decided where to invest, how to do it. As of now, very little. Just the parameters are done on state level or global level or political level as such. Then you have the actual devices, which are the phones and such. In our industry, that would be the buses and trains and taxis and car shares and all of these. But then you have this operator layer. And let's remember, in the 80s, we didn't have a personal mobile operator or a teleoperator as such. We had phones that were plugged to each other. You had a family phone and such. And now everybody has their own mobile subscription. And I was thinking that, okay, well, this is a layer that's missing. And it would be pretty easy to predict that, you know, just like your teleoperator, your mobile operator, someone would just fix the rides for you as easy as possible. And that's where the prediction kind of started 20 years ago. And it kept kind of picking up wind. And the whole movement of MaaS is a strange phenomena, because I know that there has not been evil lobbying or anything. It's just people getting that, okay, yeah, this actually makes a lot of sense. It is, because the kind of user prediction is pretty obvious. Would you like to have everything from one-stop shop so that someone just fixes and connects you with wherever you want to go? But then, you know, having been in this industry, I knew that technology early 2000 was not ready. We didn't have mobile internet. We didn't have anything. And I also knew that it's an industry where you have a lot of big, big, big players. And when you have a lot of big players, you have a lot of big barriers, egos, however you want to call it. And in order to actually create this mobility operator, none of them are alone big enough, because no one can do this one simple thing. Where I think for me, it's always the case is that, can I be your operator taking care of not 70% of your trips, not 80, but 100%? Because you can't sell a mobile operator either saying that, hey, I'll take care of 80% of your calls. I don't care about the rest. So if you need to call Finland or somewhere, go somewhere else for that. It wouldn't fly. Either you take it all or you don't. And this, there's no one out there. No public transport operator, no Uber, no car share that can actually credibly say that I can take care of all your trips. And this is kind of, for me, I always like to go from the user part of this. This is the aim of MaaS, is that you need to be able to do that. Then we go to realism. That's the funny part of MaaS. You explain it to the normal people. They all get it. Normal people being outside of mobility industry. They all get it. They say, of course, it's obvious. I would want to, you know, buy it like my mobile subscription or Netflix or however, just, you know, somebody fixing it all. That's definitely. And they only have this one question, why isn't it here yet? And then we go into the industry, and the industry has a lot of other opinions. So whereas a normal user goes, of course, I get it. This is pretty cool. The industry goes, oh, this is very, very hard. You know, technically so hard, it's hard to do.
Your analogy from the mobile phone operators is one that kind of reads across, because I remember the early days of mobile internet where they were walled gardens, barriered communities, where when you bought a Vodafone cell phone, you were only allowed to see the Vodafone mobile internet and the Vodafone games and applications, and it was completely controlled by them. And exactly as you describe our transit industry, ironically, it is a barriered city. The main barriers in our industry are the barriers, literally the subway barriers, and the gatekeepers to our industry are the literal gatekeepers who look after the gates. And those the people who are currently running those gated systems, almost as proprietary or bespoke one-off city systems with different software customized for every city. There is no platform. It's all little closed communities for a specific city with sometimes a Frankenstein's monster of things that have been assembled together over a 30-year period to make that city bus and subway and coach and light rail work. And each city you would have to engage politically and technically with on a one-off basis. And sometimes it's the technical operator who has a very closed market, walled garden approach to their software. And sometimes it's the city, local authority, who have we're the only one in charge. It's our customer. We don't want anyone else touching this player. And so you've got both the technical side and the political side, both very insular, both very city or region focused, with the idea that they are the only people who could possibly understand their riders, and they don't want anybody else there.
Yes. And this is the kind of power fight that is the hardest. And remember, you were just talking about one of the modes. And then we go into the other ones, where you go into ride hailing, which is understandable. We have huge companies that have invested billions into the supply. So why would they open up to an aggregator and so on? So everyone's looking at it from user perspective, but within their scope, not really the actual one. And there's a lot of definition issues here. Like, for example, that, yes, I see that many of those players that work within this kind of city parameters, they think of a market that the market is defined within the city. But actually, for the user, that's not the case. And for MaaS to actually start thriving, we'll have to define kind of the competitive landscape in a bit of a different way. We know for a fact that, you know, 20% of household costs go now into mobility. We also know who's the king. 76% of that money goes into the car and the car ownership. And now within the services industry, if we would all consider changing the paradigm of what is my competition. And if the competition is car against everything else, we would see it in a different format where it makes sense to actually collaborate in order to tap open that three quarters of the market, which is blocked at the moment, where you cannot actually enter. But this needs a bit of a rethinking in the whole thing of, can we actually go? And I have argued and still keep on arguing, and this is not me being kind of hatred against cars, it's just purely a commercial thing, is that the biggest question for digital disruption, for economic growth, for also for sustainability of our times, is that can we find something that is more lucrative, more valued by the customer than car ownership? If we do find, well, that opens everything. If we keep on with our own silos and just play the old game, we're never going to find it.
It's not necessarily saying car is bad. It's car should not be the automatic default. Not only are we looking at that 70% of the money spent on mobility by the private individual going to car ownership and car operating and car use, we also see a huge hidden subsidy for car-centric design, car-centric cities and car-centric infrastructure and car parking, which is almost entirely ignored when people say, let the market decide. And it's like, that would be great if we could let the market decide and let the whole cost of auto-centric infrastructure fall on the shoulders of only those who chose to use the car. I think we'd get a different answer to the one we get today.
And it's not even the cost, if you think of it. In the world of, you know, combined services or MaaS or however you want it against car ownership, the full cost is not even the whole thing, because the rest is made virtually in a not impossible, but it doesn't have the same almost constitutional right of you're almost in any, at least Western country, it is defined that with a car, you have to be able to go from any A to any B. So any address to any address, there has to be a road and it has to be maintained. It has to be done. Whereas if we look at the combination of all other modes, do we have such a societal promise? No, we don't. So in a way, car remains as your freedom insurance. And I've done personally, and we've done a lot of these interviews, actually at the moment in European cities, about 38% of people are actually looking for an alternative to car ownership. They just don't have anything that compares with it. So we are not serving roughly about 70 million cars that would want to be replaced by services. We're just not offering those services to them. You're absolutely right about that. There's a lot of hidden things. And I would say that even that it's much bigger, the hidden cost is the actual urban planning. You know, we have as people, or I'm a transport planner, urban planner, we have believed since the Futurama from 39, we have believed that, you know, the basic assumption is the car. That's your fallback of everything. So we have to build everything accordingly. We've never thought that, okay, should we actually really design it in a different way? Even in my hometown, Helsinki, where, you know, the policy is clear, pedestrians and bikers go first. But if you look at the real thing, it's, you know, most of the money still goes into the lanes, car lanes, and you can always block the, and there is no guarantee that with a bike at any time, any address you can enter.
But this city by city, some cities really are different to that. So there are cities where we were speaking about this in the last Transit Voices about Enrique de Penaloza on a truly developed international business city is one where the banker is on the public transit. If you live in New York, if you live in London, if you live in Tokyo, it is the default not to own a car. It is the default that, and again, by not having a car, you can still access one from a car share or a rental company when your journey is outside of the conurbation and outside of really good bike, walking, public transit, multimodal options, and, you know, ride hail are all there. And people mix all of these, you know, that anybody who's a public transit user will fill in the blanks at different times of day or carrying large parcels with ride hail or with other sort of delivery services without always falling back to needing a private vehicle. So
exactly it.
As we enable more of that kind of big city experience in smaller cities and regions, we can maybe get families from two cars to 1.5 or one car, because they're able to lean in to use other modes more. So I very much see it. There is a journey that can be taken, which isn't a big bang of undoing car entirely, from car dependent to car optional. And then you go from car optional to some families that are entirely private car free. Let's have a look at, we know where we wanted to go, which was facilitate car optional. And the original version of MaaS, as I interpret it, is MaaS was not only a multimodal journey planner. MaaS, as it came out of WIM and MaaS Global, was a multimodal journey planner, public and private, and payment, and the ability to wrap up all of the payments for all of those transit modes into not only one payment, but also a subscription as one of the options that was tried there. And so as an external observer, what I saw was it started with, let's get everything all behind one payment. And so we work with all of the different providers, public and private, to make sure that they accept a payment and accept a token as proof of payment, that is, we're able to show them all. And then to offer some parts of society an offer where they can pay a fixed subscription to gain access to appropriate travel modes, sometimes with a bit of metering or restriction on, sometimes unrestricted. And what we saw externally was that if that subscription came with a huge subsidy discount, then people would use it while the subsidy discount was there. And when the subsidy discount was removed, then people would stop paying for a subscription and they would just pay as you go. They would just pay for single modes. And gradually, I didn't see any trials where subscription outside of high income groups, I didn't see subscription really getting hold. So the first kind of experiment on subscription, can you describe to me as an external, you know, what you found at MaaS Global about the subscription model?
Yes, this is the interesting part. Let's start with why it's also important as a logic, because if we look at the kind of business logics of this, there are multitudes and there are some new ones that I find very interesting, but kind of coming from consumers, because there's a lot of debate, but always at the end, there's an actual person, and that is a consumer, however the paths and however goes there, and that consumer has to pay one way or another. How we saw it, and this I have to say, we did quite a mistake. We started in the beginning with mostly subscriptions, and actually by COVID, we were getting most of the profits and most of the money actually from subscriptions. But with subscriptions, you also have the low-end ones, and then you have the high-end ones. When you go in with a completely new thing into the markets, you have to have some kind of a price point in your head. For a monthly subscription, people have two price points. They have the public transport monthly, and then they have their car. There's actually nothing in between. And this is the problematic, because actually MaaS fits best somewhere in between. But to create a new category in their minds is relatively hard. I'll take an example. If we make a subscription, and yes, you're right, this is where the actual MaaS should be heading, but it's very, very little trials outside of actually WIM that have gone into subscriptions that have pricing element inside. We have very little information about the actual MaaS in any kinds of markets, mostly pay as you go. So these low-end subscriptions that are closer to the public transport, people are very price sensitive with them because they're used to public transport. They think about cost. So if we have something that is public transport plus, where you have, for example, flat rates, short range taxis, you have extra access to micromobility, and you have these perks of guaranteed days of a car with a guaranteed price and so on. So a lot of these different perks. But the kind of added value you can bring on that is relatively little. But add on that one, and we got into this prior to COVID, but then, you know, subscriptions were pretty hard during that one, so we had to stop. You add on to that one weekends of a car, which is, let's say, for a Londoner, this is a really nice one. So you have all the access to all the other modes relatively nicely, and then, you know, you can always pick up a car over the weekend. And if you put euros, you put 70 euros into this, let's say, flat rate public transport based thing, the price elasticity of adding a couple of euros, it's relatively strong in that one. And you say that, hey, top that with the cars, and you put 250 euros as a price. So just the weekends of a car, and people perceive that as, is it a bit too low? So is it too actually too low because they have the price point of actual car there? So the trick of everything, and this, for example, even us, we didn't go too far, but there are some good examples of it. The trick of this is actually the whole mass, kind of the best way of creating money is that you create the price perception of the car in the minds of the person. This, the average price of that is 616 euros a month in Europe. And yes, there's the argument that people don't know that, but more and more car is also servitized. So they start to have a price point in their head that it's relatively high. And then it's the production thing. So the less you will need the car to actually fulfill this promise of mobility, and the more you use public transport, the more money you're making. And for that, we started to have, prior to us having to flip after COVID and then going after the financial crisis into different mode, we started actually getting quite lucrative and actually well profitable customers in the range of playing with this monthly pricing of access to car, but utilizing the cheaper modes even more. So this kind of is the basic logic. And sadly, it's relatively untrialed yet because you need to be able to take some risks in it. Like you said, there needs to be rules. Like, for example, we tried for 7 years, we've had these customers of unlimited. So you have unlimited taxis, unlimited cars, unlimited public transport, everything unlimited. Surprise, surprise, their modal split was always going upwards with public transport, so for example. And we saw them using a lot of city bikes and doing all of that. So of
course, that's a really good result. So you're saying when you give someone unrestricted access to cars, yes, ride hail, bikes, public transit and everything else, over time, their habits shift.
Actually, yes.
How many users roughly are we talking about in this category?
More or less hundreds, but over a period of 6-7 years.
Hundreds over a period of 6 or 7 years. Okay.
So there's at least some data. And then we've had different types of packages. We had an interesting one just prior to COVID where we had about 100 customers where, you know, this is, you know, give access to everything, do what you want, and then we can nudge you towards some more sustainable modes.
That group of a few hundreds was individually profitable, but you were running a system that was available to the whole country, weren't you?
Just in Helsinki, yeah, we just limited this. And we also limited the number of users because the risk of losing.
And the financial risk of overrun. So
We were able to start finding who are the right customers. Yes, we had those that were misusing it for quite a lot of purposes and we had to get rid of them. This is also happened in mobile. I mean, you know, you have fair use rules in these. But we did start to find and even find the segment of where and what type of people can we find for these, let's say, relatively high priced subscriptions that are also profitable, where this is lifestyle. We also, how we put mass in different categories is that, you know, the level one is this information, like you said. Level two is booking and payment. So you have a bit more. Level three is in subscriptions where you start having multimodal subscription. And it's this in where you replace, you know, you have the capacity of what people pay a lot for and you can replace it with a cheaper one where you start making money. But the actual price jewel is where it's a lifestyle thing. And these kinds of elements really start to play in the game. We had another one where we made a trial that was actually very good prior to COVID, where using AI, we actually said, now you have access to everything, but let us help you with how to get there. We created this algorithm that say, okay, you want to go there. This is your trip that's included in your 250 euro rate. If you want to upgrade, it's only a bit more as such. But we would do it in a way that we guarantee that you're never delayed more than 10 minutes if we compare it with a car ride. So we can actually be quite good in this. And, you know, when it's a rainy day, we don't make you walk. We'll give you a free taxi and so on and so on. So a lot of these parameters. So that goes not from the perspective of production, from perspective of the end user, what they value. And with these parameters, we can make it a bit more high end, a bit more low end. And this was quite an interesting one. Coming on forward into this one, we're just gotten into a very small pilots, which I do believe is the future of corporate cars, for example, is that we had this unlimited thing, everything, cars, taxis, everything, go do whatever you want. But the company will give you a CO2 limit. They will set that actual, not this type of whatever average use, but actual use of CO2. So if you want to knock yourself out with a Hummer, you might get a couple of hundred kilometers. Do it. It's fine. But then you pay for the rest. But if you are a bit more sustainable, we'll actually reward you. And if you save on CO2, we might upgrade your next business flight to business and so on and so on. So oh, this fun. I see as a future. So we really need to play it. Once you have built it, you can start really playing with the pricing, with the service level, because I often say, but it's not said enough, in the concept of mobility as a service, the last word is the one that matters. It's the service that people are kind of keen on.
Yeah.
Every user study we did, it was the convenience, it was the service that they value above everything. And just displaying information, doing a bit of booking, doesn't excite them. And how we found out, even though we had all the different modes and all the different players, if it's just booking and payment, most of them used it for either a taxi app or they used it as a public transport app. They didn't really realize what the whole thing was about unless you make the pricing also work.
So in terms of the journey, what you were saying is you were finding that there were some customers in this few hundred that did look like they might be profitable on an individual basis if it could be scaled and control the risk around over users.
Actually, we found out we had also low-end subscriptions, and we did find out the profitable segments out of subscriptions also for the low-end subscriptions. For example, in Helsinki, you can pinpoint it into 10 postal codes where you can find a segment that's most lucrative to you. And it's not a very small fragment of people. Actually.
And is this basically analogous to like period passes? This is just like a month of public transit as a fixed price.
Yes. And always the trick of this is that the most profitable ones are those that use at least 3 different modes per month. So the ones where if you're just one mode wonder, why would you use a MaaS app? Because probably the public transport or the Voi or Tier, they have a better, much more flexible use. Our kind of convenience or MaaS convenience comes from those that are naturally using a lot of different modes, that are naturally using different apps, and they want the convenience of, okay, all in one, very simply.
Okay. I mean, as you know, Masabi has been involved in MaaS provision as well. And our take on it is a variant. We do what we call practical MaaS, where instead of an app and a subscription, we try and surface the public transit segment inside multimodal journey planners, which have private ride hail and scooters and everything else in them, but without the certainly, and I think this is one of the things that you've been pushing, not making it local authority or transit authority centric. So instead of a transit authority for a city or a region saying, we're going to run MaaS and have a local authority app, we were very much saying, no, the public transit is the public transit, private transit is private transit. And there are multimodal journey planners and multimodal sales applications, which in some cases are global. You know, these are the big journey planners. And most people, when they're doing their regular journeys, exactly as you just described, people who use a single mode in their commutes, etc., they don't really need MaaS. It's only when you're doing an unfamiliar journey or an unusual journey that doesn't fit nicely into a single mode that you go to a journey planner, that you go to Google Maps, that you go somewhere to say, how do I do this journey in this unusual city? And so we're very much saying, well, when they do, you know, somebody with a habit around I land in a new town and I get out the Uber app, if when they do the Uber journey plan, we can show them the public transit and without having to sign up a local city app and a local city smart card and load that up. If we can just, in the same way that Uber magically makes the payments happen behind the scenes and you don't even think about it, if we can have your Uber stored credit card look after your payment for public transit, then that worked for that little niche. And it was very much, we saw practical MaaS as something that isn't trying to necessarily service 80% of the regular commuters in the city. We very much saw MaaS as something to really help people who are in an unusual situation. Either their primary transit mode is broken today and they're having to make up the journey a different way at a strange time of day, or they're in an unfamiliar city and we want to make discoverability work. But for us, really, in the mobility as a service, instead of service being the main thing, it was mobility. And I was wondering whether or not MaaS as a political movement is more trying to enable car-light living by making sure mobility can be serviced and discoverable with very little friction. And it's maybe less important to have it all wrapped up in one payment? I mean, from your point of view, how important was accessing mobility versus single point of payment?
You cannot create the services before you have the elements of single point payment, before you have these elements out there. You actually hit it the right way. Even though I know that for sure, you know, there will be much more integration within the field of mobility because it's just more convenient. But I think it would be kind of, who are we to say how the consumer really likes to consume it? And this brings me to a point where I think that the industry is heading as next one, because for a full-blown independent MaaS provider, in order for you to make it big, you need quite a lot of investment into user acquisition. And in the current frame of financial world, I don't see that happening within the next years that someone will get enough money, except for the big mobility players that have the money already. They might be doing it. But yeah, as independent but
this is one of the things I specifically see as an unwise use of public funds. Because definitely, sometimes we see cities, especially some cities in Europe, trying to make a local authority-centric MaaS app. They're going to try and market it to do the customer acquisition. Mm. And they're trying to beat Google Maps and Apple Maps. Yeah. They're trying to beat MoveIt. They're trying to beat CityMapper. They're trying to beat venture capital funded business and multinational companies. A single city app. They're trying to say, you land in Berlin Airport and we're going to have huge hoardings trying to make sure that international travelers are going to download and sign up a user account and put payment details into a Berlin-only app. And I just find this really weird. Why on earth would the public sector use taxpayer money to try and compete with something that, to be honest, is done pretty well by private sector?
I kind of understand it. You know, you have this new phenomenon, MaaS, and the city authorities, they kind of want to promote it one way or another. And the tool that they have is let's design and tender that. And they kind of fall into this trap over and over and over again, which more or less actually prohibits the development of MaaS in many ways, because as good as it could be, and I would love it as a transport engineer, because then I could dictate what the people use, but it's not scalable. And I know how extremely expensive it is to have a good UX for an app in mobility.
Not only the good UX in the WIM app, but then you've got to continuously re-engineer all of your APIs and links to all of those other underlying transport systems and billing systems. And that's very expensive. Yes.
And it's not a project where, you know, you invest and then it's undone. You keep the development all the time. So it's impossible to have these city apps. Well, look, I was part of the development of how the map business developed. And I saw exactly the same thing. It was also for the public transit info. And first it started with cities wanting to build their own apps. We all know that, you know, now it's a global business. Same will happen with MaaS. Sad that we have to go through the same evolution phases again. But this brings me to where I think that the kind of market is going. If we take another analogy, the way that Klarna and others, what they did with payment and financing and insurances as well, now you go and you buy a sofa at IKEA or something, and they'll say, do it with financing or not. And it's not them, but there are companies that make it really easy to do the financing in the background. It's embedded financing, or in this case, I'd like to call it maybe mobility as a feature. So who are we to say how they want to consume it? In a way, if I want to buy my mobility together with my rent, which is a very obvious place to plug it in, why shouldn't I? Why should we not offer these MaaS or multimodality, like you said, in that sense, for a Tesco, if they want to have in their Tesco app how to reach Tesco's multimodally? Why do we not give these to insurance companies? Why do we not give these? So I think that the obvious kind of next stage, and this started when somebody, it was a doctor who was asking that what other things will be integrated into MaaS. And I said that this is a pretty arrogant way of thinking. From us in mobility, why do we think that everything will integrate to us? Why don't we think that we should actually integrate to other businesses, other sectors? I think it's more obvious to do it that way.
So this is saying when you buy an airline ticket, it builds in the public transit. Yes. When I buy a hotel room, it'll build in the travel.
Why wouldn't a Hilton say that within your Hilton app, you can actually now also get anywhere you are, you get the local transit or taxis or micromobility, and it follows the same one. I don't know whether it works that way, But who are we to say? Eventually is where the consumer wants it most conveniently. And actually, as a business logic, this makes a lot of sense, because instead of validating parking for hotels, instead of validating parking for malls, Tesco's and others, why don't you validate mobility with the same price?
Well, this certainly is coming closer to some of the political moves where employers who provide free parking, but no financial benefit to people who use bicycles, active transport and public transport. That's kind of coming under the spotlight. And we're saying, well, actually, the amount of money tied up in providing that parking space is quite large. And so you're giving a huge invisible subsidy, a huge invisible benefit to those with the most polluting and the most congestion-causing choice. So if you can say, well, here is the equivalent benefit to everybody who's going by bike, and I think in Holland and in some other places, for every kilometer cycled, you give a tax-free bonus to people who are using those modes, which is great. But how that's consumed, again, you said earlier, should be something we give as a choice to the consumer, not something that we impose as the city. And this brings me to a real tension in urban ticketing. The real movement we've had recently for getting people to be able to access subways and buses and trains and public transit in major urban cities and other places, a lot has been done around open payments, open loop. This idea that instead of using a Helsinki smart card and a London smart card and something else, you can use a universal token that's connected to payments, otherwise known as a bank payment card, it's EMV, and tap it around the system and have that work out whether you should have had a single return, a day pass, an A to B, a monthly pass, just for bus and rail or whatever it is. And in doing so, we've flipped it round. And instead of it being an app where the customer re-chooses a subscription and plays the game of whether or not this month I'm actually going to be going into town a lot or this month I'm going to be working from home more, it figures it out after the fact, what would have been the best choice. And if there is a monthly capped subscription price, then it caps you at that. If in the end, two or three singles would have been better, you get the two or three singles, but you didn't commit up front with a prepay subscription. And what's wonderful about these contactless tap situations is that it has no interface whatsoever. Your travel around the city, the friction around that payment and around the pre-choice has gone. And what supports you in living a multimodal existence in the city, mixing between Ubers and subways and other things, they're not in the same payment. But it's that the Uber has almost no payment friction and the tapping your bank card has no payment friction. You know, that does let you do a lot of things and it works in lots of cities.
It's definitely this kind of thing that first you need to be able to tap into everything before you can even start building any type of future for MaaS, however you want to describe it. And this has been one of the biggest barriers. If we think of it from another angle, where to me the whole MaaS has been, take it from a dream perspective. So what if, just dream a bit, and I know you know technology, that is actually not, technically it's not impossible. Let's take Europe, for example. And I'm a coder engineer, and I kind of would want to do something, I have a brilliant idea how to do mobility for this and this segment, this and this way. What if I were able to just, you know, on a one night, I would be able to tap into the whole public transport network of the whole of Europe? Just like that. So I would have it with me. And yes, with these kinds of approaches, either yes, I can buy single tickets or something, or I can tap into this capped payment where, you know, I can just plug it in like that. And with that, I could innovate. However, I kind of like to think of it that this could be the new iOS of, you know, development. And it's really not that much about how does a city engineer come up with an app like that. It's what kind of innovation would that enable? And I can guarantee if we would have that ongoing, that there would be a burst of innovation coming in. And actually, of course, as a European, I am a bit worried that we would have all the chances in Europe, but we're kind of playing these sub-optimized city kind of games, which are not bringing us forward in the actual innovation.
I agree. And funnily enough, there is a movement that is gradually creating exactly what you're describing. And it's the account-based ticketing movement.
Exactly. So
account-based ticketing of looking at what somebody's done and creating a price and a product on that currently is single city or single agency style, but there are currently moves going on to allow multi-agency, multimodal or multi-region account-based ticketing to work, whether that's tapping contactless bank cards or stored value accounts or prepay accounts or direct debit postpay accounts. And the conversations are coming along to how do we allow somebody else to look at those taps and say, I want to bid with a different product solution and gather up not only these taps in this area, but one or two there and say, well, I'm now going to do a new mobility offering, which I am taking the commercial risk on, or I am taking a larger commercial kind of wrapper around, but without having to dominate the normal commuter tickets. So you can say, I'm actually going to let most people who only travel exactly as you described within one mode and let them just go completely normally. But then when I see one of these customers who is very multimodal and it unbeknownst to the public transit operators is also pulling in some private, I can then say, right, I've got a price that's going to do that. I've got a side commercial agreement with some of the ride hail providers and a commercial agreement with some of the public transit operators, put a joint price together. And to be able to tell everyone, right, those taps don't capture those with your normal pricing. I've captured that and I will settle with you separately under a different commercial arrangement. The commercial arrangements are tricky, but it does start with exactly as you said, how does the developer at least access that at the beginning to even offer that in a pilot basis? And if we can get to the point where our account-based ticketing goes multi-island, allows two regions to actually occasionally join a product between the two, then I think we might get there. And it's something that's going on in UK rail and bus at the moment. It's a debate. And we're trying to figure out if we all end up behind a central system where everything has to be decided by one central pricing engine, or a decentralized one where a new developer or a new project can try and come up with a new bit of innovation and try that without having to drag everyone else with them. And that's definitely where we're trying to pull it, which might allow this next generation of mass to happen.
That's a very good point. And yes, the account ticketing, account-based ticketing can be kind of a big enabler for this, provided that it's, I would like to use, steal the term from telecom industry and use the word roaming. You know that it wasn't the case beginning of 90s, that it was definitely not there. And this is where EU kind of showed its capabilities, that it was forced roaming actually, because it was in the interest of the users. And this could be imposed relatively easily as well. Eventually good for the business, but I'm not sure if this roaming will happen without a bit of force and a bit of regulation on it. So definitely account-based ticketing, but account-based ticketing that is done just for Bristol doesn't really solve much, doesn't it?
Yeah.
If it's
that's wonderful. Well, wrapping up, it's if we make account-based ticketing decentralized and then enable roaming, maybe that's yes. The enabler to allow this for those interesting niches, those nudges to make public transport or car light experience more accessible to people in those unusual situations. Maybe we'll get people to gradually transition away from everything being default car. How exciting. So what's next for you? Is it a bit early for you to have a plan for what you do next?
If you try to run a revolutionary startup as such, you don't do it by making plan Bs. That's all. Of course, you know, fight until the last minute and you fight full, which means that, of course, I have no plan Bs for a period of time thinking. I hope for at least a short period of or however period of time, I could help others by doing some advisory roles and seeing from that. But let's see first what the home for the assets of Musk Global is and then pick it up from there.
Yeah. It's something we ask all of our guests. Of all of the ideas that you've seen, what would you categorize as the current transport or mobility idea that you think is probably overhyped and is consuming too much attention right now, your boondoggle? And then where is the underdog that we should move that attention and funding towards?
I come from the space of Mars, I would say, and hopefully nobody kicks me for this, but these city projects or even local projects of Mars are still a bit overhyped. I am really sorry to say, because there are a lot of people who really want to make them happen, But I just see no way that that can be thriving.
I have to agree. It's exactly as you said, making a good enough UI and all of the back-end integrations means you're spending millions and end up servicing a few hundred users.
It's a bit, if we take the analogy, we all societally, we wanted that the car should be electrified, but it didn't mean that the city council will start selling the cars or tendering it in a way that, okay, for the Bristol citizens, we will tender that which of the car OEMs gets to provide this one model of car to the citizens, let alone starting to produce them. You created the environment so that it makes easier for that market to start thriving. That's the approach that it's a must. It's very hard to regulate that I give, but it's the only way to success. We do see some good ones, especially in Italy, Turin. I'm expecting a lot.
Okay. What's the underdog? Where would you take the money and attention being put into city-specific mass? Where would you move that to instead?
Well, this bugs me. A couple of things that we didn't really get orderly done. One is really go after the subscriptions, but even more so because I see a very easy path of doing this embedded mobility or mobility as a feature. If you can go and you can ask any type of player with whether it's a retail or mall or events or something like that, if they would want to just plug in all mobility into their app, and they will say yes. The problem is that nobody's offering that now. We only have those players that will offer their services, but that's not good enough. If you're Tesco, why would you just plug into Uber or things? You will want to be a bit more independent, not to have vendor lock-in as such. You want all the modes. And nobody's offering that with a very easy plug-in type of thing. And this, because I see a very obvious future, and it bugs me that we didn't do it.
Right, so mobility is a feature tagged onto other industries, yes, and other services to complete the customer's experience, including travel.
There's nobody in the field at the moment who's capable of providing that.
Right. And lastly, another voice. Who do you think we should also speak to get another angle on the world of mobility?
Well, if you are thinking of this, how the city should approach this mass, the Turin city at the moment, there's an organization called 5T. Maybe Matteo Antoniola might be the right person to talk. Their attitude towards how to push the markets is a really very intriguing one.
Fantastic. I'll have a chat with Matteo. Thank you so much for coming on today, Sampo. Hearing your story and reflections, and especially what you see coming next, has been really eye-opening. And I look forward to seeing what happens next with mobility as a feature.
Yeah, we'll see.
Oh, thank you so much to Sampo for coming in to tell us more. Interesting to hear where the battle started with the egos of the big operators and transport providers who wanted to control the customer entirely and not open things up. It's great that we're now seeing other channels tailored to where the riders really are. It's interesting that he said we've got to reframe our competition not as other public transport providers and mobility providers, but the competition of the private car that we have to provide a better solution against. Certainly reframing against the price, the whole all-in price of car use. Interesting result that giving someone unrestricted mass does lead to an increase in their mass transit use and a reduction of individual vehicle use, even when that's provided if essentially within one price. Certainly we still disagree on whether a single payment is where everything should be, but in wild agreement that city-specific mass offerings competing with the big transit planners might not be the best spend of public money. Thank you so much. Let's see what happens next if account-based ticketing does enable a second resurgence of mass. Tune in next month for more from Transit Voices.
You've listened to Transit Voices, the podcast by transit nerds for transit nerds. Don't forget to subscribe to Transit Voices to keep up with the latest editions on your favorite podcast platform.